Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning to our next to the last program of the season. So I want to remind you that next week's program, which will be a newly released report, not yet released report, on the Central New York skills gap, will be the final of the season. Of course, there are a lot of other things that I can tell you about to keep you busy for the rest of the spring and the summer, and I'll go into that a little bit next week. Speaking of report releases, though, I hope you all saw that the Onondaga Citizens League study on early childhood and school readiness was released on Monday. It was a great event, those of you who were there. Those of you who are Onondaga Citizens League members will be getting a hard copy of the report in the mail very shortly. In the meantime, it is on the OCL website at OnondagaCitizensLeague.org. Also, I'm going to end the questions, today's panel, a few minutes early, and we will be presenting the 2014 Meritorious Service to the Community Award to someone, okay. I'm going to leave it at that. So don't go away right after the questions. To someone. All right. Well, this morning it is my pleasure to introduce Barbara Crowfoot, professor at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. And she is our moderator this morning, and she is going to introduce the rest of the panel. Thank you so much, Barbara. Thank all of you for being here this morning. Appreciate it, and we look forward to it every year.
Thank you. It is great to be back, and I almost always teach on Thursday morning, so I don't get here too often, so it's nice to see all of you again. And welcome to the Ivory Tower TMR Special Edition this morning. Let me introduce the panel that's going to talk today about the news. On your let's see, left, my far right, is David Rubin, who is from the Newhouse School and is the traditional moderator of the program. And he's at Syracuse University, of course. Lisa Dolak from the College of Law at Syracuse University. Christy Anderson from the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Tara Ross from Onondaga Community College. And Bob Spitzer from SUNY Cortland. Good morning, everyone. Well, there was a headline in the New York Post this week that caught David's attention, and it says, Cuomo, amidst the Moreland struggles, realizes he might lose. And as is common during the week, one of us will send something out, and so David sent that out, and then there was a ping in the email, and then a ping, and then a ping, 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 and I confess I gave up because there were more than two dozen back and forths. But that says to me, hey, there's a good topic to be talking about. So we will the panel will be a little different tomorrow night, but we'll also be talking about the same topics, but I guarantee the discussion will be somewhat different. With the budget deal that the legislature and the governor came to was the demise, as I'm sure you know, of the Moreland Commission, which was supposed to ferret out corruption and cronyism in New York politics. And also, I think Cuomo took a hit for trying something on public financing, which kind of backfired on him. And all those of us who had hoped for some kind of ethics reform were certainly upset. And so it comes time to say, is Fred Dicker right? Is there a chance that Cuomo might lose? And I think, David, you think there might be.
Well, probably not, but hope springs eternal. Barbara's allowed me to frame this discussion, much to the chagrin of Bob Spitzer, who doesn't agree with me. Let me just make a couple points to get us started. Our governor is a topic on which I could write a book. First, I think the way he's handled the issue of fracking says a lot about the governor, which is that he hasn't handled it. And I'm not saying anything about whether we should frack or we shouldn't frack. All I'm saying is it's an important decision, environmentally and economically. He's the governor of the state. He should make a decision. He's had more than enough time to make this decision. and his transparently false statements that he doesn't have enough data wore thin for me years ago. But we know why he hasn't made a decision, and that's because the job he's in is not the job he wants. And the job he wants, which is President of the United States, he doesn't want to do anything as controversial as a decision on fracking would be. So who pays the price for his hubris and his job ambitions? We do. But it's a key to his personality. What I've learned about this governor's MO is that he's into what I call bait and switch. He rolls out a tremendously aggressive sounding agenda, whether it be ethics reform, property tax reform, the redistricting process for voting. He gets everybody excited. He puts himself on the side of the reformers. And then a few months later, the whole thing peters out. And the press, by and large, has given him a pass in that it peters out. And his publicity engine is such that he throws up enough chaff that you don't quite realize that it's petered out. And so, in the end, a governor who presents himself as an agent of change and a reformer is, in fact, quite the opposite. He is part of the status quo, and he is keeping Albany pretty much the way that it is. The way campaign finance reform finally played out, which was to force it on our controller, Tom DiNapoli, who you may recall sided with our mayor on the issue of the governor's plan on smoothing out pension payments, which enraged the governor and has made him the enemy of our mayor and our city and of DiNapoli. So who is it who's supposed to end up as the test case in public financing? DiNapoli. Typical. He goes after his enemies, claims it's reform, and it's not. Last, on this Moreland Commission, which was supposed to be the club he was holding over the legislature to bring about ethics reform, he doesn't get the ethics reform he promised. He stops the Moreland Commission, and he stops it because it was getting too close to shining a light on what is the key problem in Albany, which is the outside income that members of the Senate and the Assembly get, such that their votes in Albany are tied more to their own outside interests than they are to your interests and my interests. That's what one of the things the Moreland Commission was getting at. And he shut it down. And why did he shut it down? Well, he said it was only meant to be temporary. But if you didn't get the ethics reform you wanted, the smart thing to do would be to keep it running. Because the longer it's running, and the more it's investigating, and the more evidence it's getting, the hotter it gets for the very people you need to change their views on ethics in Albany, which is the members of the Senate and the Assembly. So it makes no sense to close it down, except if you understand that the governor is not serious about ethics reform, nor, in my view, is he serious about any reform in this state. What he's serious about is 2016.
I think, David, you offer some legitimate criticisms, but I think your analysis is all wrong. First and foremost, he is a governor who acts... Cuomo may well have ambitions for higher office, but he does not act like a political placeholder. He acts like a man who wants to be governor, and he behaves like a man who enjoys being governor. Now, how do you assess Cuomo's first 3.5 years? Here we are, it's 2014. He was elected in 2010. And if you take a step back and look at what's happened in the last 3.5 years, it's been a whirlwind of activity. And I'm going to offer some bullet points, but and I say this noting that, you know, most of these things have happened with the state legislature. He isn't doing these things by himself, by and large, although some of them he has been. First of all, we've had four on-time state budgets, first time since Rockefeller that this has happened. He closed a $10 billion state deficit gap that he inherited when he took office in 2011. He set up regional development councils. He established the Startup New York program, the tax-free zones for new businesses around SUNY campuses, and I work at a SUNY campus, and we're starting to see some things happening where we are. He made a deal with Native Americans to get tax revenues from them from their sale of cigarettes and gambling casinos, and he did it by leveraging state controlled casinos. You might argue that the new state casinos might not make very much money, but even if they deliver no net profits, they've done at least two things. One is they're employing a bunch of people, and secondly, he's successfully leveraged the Native American nations to pay taxes for the first time. No governor has been able to make that deal. Cuomo made that deal. Tax rates in New York State today are the lowest they've been in 60 years. They're still high, to be sure. There's an agreement to build a new Tappan Zee Bridge down in New York City. Gay marriage was legalized in New York State. Politically, that was a gigantic... I mean, you can agree or disagree with legalizing gay marriage, but politically, that was a gigantic accomplishment. And people, I think, and certainly David, does not realize how prodigious an accomplishment that was in purely political terms. The legislature adopted at his behest the New York Safe Act, the gun control law, which again is controversial, although 60% of New Yorkers support it. Again, you could agree or disagree, but the fact is he set out to do it and got it done. He negotiated new contracts with state unions that are very tough. I'm a state employee, and I can tell you in more detail later how the kinds of measures that have been included in my union state contract and other state employees and how it's affected us. And there's some significant digs in there that will affect future funding in the ways cutting back on future spending by the state that have not been in there before. So it's more money for the state. It's not so good for me, but I'm just saying. We have something called a rational tuition policy, which we never had, not in decades. And I can explain why that is significant. That's the first time that that has happened. The new budget, the 2013 budget, had a $1.3 billion new tax cut across 3 years. He has sustained a bipartisan relationship with the state legislature that we have not seen with any governors in New York State in decades. And most recently, there was a report that came out yesterday from the Tax Foundation, a nonprofit think tank in D.C., which notes that New York's overall business tax climate ranking has improved two spots from the bottom, number 50, to number 48, ahead of California and New Jersey. It's more than zero. And more significantly, the report noted that New York's corporate tax system is much improved, according to them, than the overall ranking. New York's corporate tax system is ranked now 25th best out of 50 states. And the report said that, quote, the broad-based changes to the corporate tax are impressive and will greatly reduce complexities and burdens in New York's corporate tax structure.
Okay, I think we get it.
Okay, but the bottom line is that this has happened because of Cuomo. And you can agree or disagree, but he has been a man in motion for 3.5 years.
Christy, a man in motion?
If I had to pick David or Bob to agree with, I would agree with Bob. I think David has focused on a few things that he's upset about, and I think, as some of our email conversation suggested, I think that your expectations, David, about Cuomo were perhaps higher than the rest of ours. I mean, he's a politician, you know. And one of the things that I have been surprised at is his somewhat lack of political skills in some ways, in a number of ways. One is something you alluded to, David, which is this vengeful kind of aspect to him. I think a good politician doesn't do that, and I mean, most of the time. And his treatment of Stephanie Miner, I think, and this recent possible vengeful act against Tom DiNapoli, I think really are not very wise, and they seem sort of impulsive and not very skilled politically. And it also, these and other things he has decided or not decided sort of make me think he doesn't have And I don't know the details of his organization or the people around him in Albany, but sort of make me think he doesn't have the kind of people around him who he will listen to and who can give him wise advice. You know, don't do this or do it this way or whatever. The fracking is one example of that. Yes, he has plenty of data. He could have made a decision. And he could have couched that. The decision can be made somewhere in the middle. He doesn't have to say, you know, ban fracking or allow it to happen in an uncontrolled way. I mean, it seems to me that personally, probably a decision that could be made without too much political fallout is some, a heavily regulated kind of going forward that process. But the Moreland Commission even more struck me as something that he did sort of, I really wonder what the inside story of that was. I mean, here's something he set up, and he got all these fairly heavy-duty people to participate in it, and they seem to be really learning things and coming up with things. And then all of a sudden he says, okay, I've got this really lame ethics reform and stupid little tiny bit of campaign finance reform, and because I've got that, I'm disbanding this commission. That just seemed crazy to me. And I don't explain it just that he wants to be president. That doesn't seem to explain it to me. I would also mention in this line the property tax reform. As an elected official, I am just outraged by the way he has dealt with municipalities in this way, saying that municipalities have to do the hard thing and cut back our expenditures when most of our expenditures or the increase in our expenditures is totally due to the state. And this is related to the way he has kind of refused to listen to Stephanie Miner or other mayors who have talked about the financial problems of the city being connected to the state. So, and I think I just can't believe that Cuomo couldn't have come up with a better way of dealing with these state, the relationship between the state and the various municipalities. It doesn't seem like very politically skilled maneuvering to me. So that's my take on it.
Go ahead, Lisa.
I come out somewhere in the middle. I mean, I agree that David mysteriously expects way too much of Cuomo. I said to him yesterday, you know, the last two governors haven't been a day at the beach, and I don't remember you getting all worked up about them nearly as much.
I didn't expect anything.
Well, okay. Okay. I don't know why you would have expected so much of Cuomo. I have to disagree with Christy in the notion that the issue is that he doesn't have the right advisors. I think he's very much his father's son, and I think what he says goes. I don't think he takes much advice from anybody.
That's my point.
Well, maybe he should, but I think he certainly should, but I don't think he will. Where I get hung up on the notion that he's motivated by his presidential chances is that he doesn't have any. And I say that because, I mean, first and foremost, he's completely alienated his base because on all these economic measures, you know, the anti-union measures, the fight with de Blasio, the corporate tax. I mean, economically, he's behaved more conservatively than, you know, some conservative governors have. So I don't understand if his plan is to run for president. I don't see how he gets there, aside from all the other issues, including the people that are obviously in front of him in terms of their chances. So that doesn't make sense to me. The Moreland Commission thing is bizarre and mysterious, and if there's something illegal there, then I think we've got a good chance of getting to the bottom of it in the person of the U.S. attorney, who seems to be quite exercised about this. So I guess my view is I have faith in the law, David, and I think if there's something really weird there, then this guy Bharara seems quite motivated to get to the bottom of it, and we'll find that out. But I don't understand it either. And any notion that this commission that was set up, 8 months ago or something, I mean, that it's accomplished what it set out to accomplish is just facially ridiculous. So that is quite a disappointment. But I think bottom line is, David has put me in the bizarre position of defending a Democrat. So, but, you know. That's how, I guess, how far you've gone this time.
I'm realizing one of the beauties of television is there is a director that's keeping us moving along here, and the professors are coming out here. But let's quickly get to Tara, and I'm going to give David a rebuttal. But Tara, what do you think? Where are you on this?
Well, actually, I think that he's actually played well to sort of his base in the sense that he's played to concerns, issues of people in the middle class. Where he's lost are minorities, unions, et cetera. And what he's doing right now does set him up fairly well for a national election. It doesn't set him up well for running again for governor. So, you know, I think he does have presidential aspirations. And, you know, I don't necessarily know that he'll go very far with them, but certainly he'll make himself an early contender.
David, have we convinced you?
Yeah, right. So three. Basically, I think that Christie's on my side, not so much in the middle, but just three quick responses. One on the regional economic development councils. I credit him for coming up with the idea. It's a good one because it took away from Albany the decision as to what would work in our area, and that's smart. It took away from the individual legislators the chance for their own member items, and that's good. The problem is that Cuomo doesn't believe in his own strategy. So when you look, for example, at this crazy stadium project that the county executive brought here, that stadium project has nothing to do with the regional economic plan for us that was carefully worked out by our local people. Nor does this nanotechnology film program in DeWitt have anything to do with this. If you take a look at what Rob Simpson and the Center State people, because he's the co-chair of this, worked out, that stuff has nothing to do with it. So that Cuomo is off doing his own usual thing, where he says, this is what's good for you, and there's way more money he's thrown at that than he was putting into the economic development councils. Casinos, totally regressive. Totally regressive as a way to raise money. Cynical. And last, gay marriage. Yes, he got it done. If he hadn't got it done, the judiciary in this state gets it done. So big deal.
Just one thing on the Moreland Commission. Remember that he set up Cuomo set up the Moreland Commission because the state legislature refused to act on ethics. It was his own volition and his own initiative, and it was a bipartisan group. He puts Republicans on it, Bill Fitzpatrick and others. And you missed the middle step, that he had his people starting to, you know, call them and wheedle them and kind of press them in terms of their work, and then cuts the legs out from under Moreland. And, you know, he should be criticized for that, but my theory, for which I have no evidence, is that he made some kind of deal with the legislature because the legislature hates ethics reform above all things. It is their top priority. And so if you're making a deal on a budget and everything else, maybe that's the deal that they made.
I hope we figure that out.
He said basically, yeah, I made a deal. I got something,
okay.
But he didn't get much.
Hopefully that will come out. Let me turn us to our second topic. There were Pulitzer Prizes awarded this week, and as you know, the one for public service went to the Guardian's U.S. operation and to the Washington Post for their expose of the secret surveillance program from the National Security Administration. Those publications were heavily criticized when they did that. American diplomacy was embarrassed and perhaps foreign relations hurt. And it engendered really a very healthy public discussion about democracy, about privacy, about how much information is classified and who does that. A lot of people saw this public service award by the Pulitzers as an easy call. Some people saw it as quite courageous, and some people thought it was quite disastrous. Lisa, I wonder if you think, is this a public service?
Without question, it was a public service. To me, this was a very easy call. In fact, I think the bizarre thing would have been had the Pulitzer for public service not gone to these recipients. It was a tremendous public service in the vein of the Pentagon Papers and the Watergate revelations. And, as you said, began a public dialogue that we would not have been having, forced the president to answer questions he would not have had to answer and didn't want to answer, has resulted in policy changes, exposed tremendous government overreach. So no question about that.
David has been a Pulitzer judge, and I wonder if you have any insights on what might have gone on in that room and the discussions they might have had to and fro about whether to do this.
Well, let me come at it slightly differently. That is that this is the journalism establishment speaking in the prizes. And so what I took away from awarding this prize was this was a kind of shot across the president's bow, in that the journalistic establishment is not happy with the closed nature of this presidency. Despite the fact that Obama speaks about transparency, he doesn't actually walk that walk. And so his statement that he always wanted this debate about secrecy is not true, and he still hasn't had the debate about secrecy despite all this. So giving the prize to the Post was a message directly to the administration that journalists are on a much different side from this. The other thing is that it proves once again that journalists and many people in the United States are very different. Journalists are weird people. And there are polls that show journalists are much less religious and church-going than most Americans. Journalists tend to support abortion in numbers that most people don't. Journalists tend to be more against guns than most people are. Journalists are much more suspicious of government than most Americans are. And I could go on. Journalists are different. And that's what makes them, to me, so valuable, because they are adversarial. Their job is to write things that people really don't want to read but need to know. And so on this issue of the NSA, many people see the whole Snowden thing as traitorous and damaging to the country. Journalists see it just the opposite. That is, that's nonsense. There is no damage to the country. The damage to the country has been not knowing what our government has been doing. And this prize is all about that divide.
Tara, let me bring you in on this.
Well, David, you're absolutely right. This is all about the journalists. This award was so predictable, it's incredible, because this is something that journalists care about, journalists focus on. I'm not saying that other Americans don't, but other Americans don't rate this as important as journalists tend to, political analysts may tend to. And so to me, that if they hadn't given it to the Guardian U.S. and to the Washington Post, it would have been strange. Quite frankly, I think there were better stories that they could have given it to.
I just wanted to say, David, that I think Tara has kind of nailed it. Your description of how journalists are different makes them sound just like they're more liberal than the population, and I think they may be, but I think the key difference is precisely that they look at issues differently, and they look at issues regarding civil liberties and press freedom and freedom of speech and openness differently. There was a Doyle McManus in the LA Times had a good, I think, editorial about this, saying, yes, it was a good award. It had a lot of impact, produced a lot of discussion and reforms. It also was good journalistic quality, that they put a lot of people on this. They just didn't dump out the stuff and so on. But at the end, he said, history has taught journalists over and over that disclosure is almost always better than concealment. When in doubt, our job is to publish and let the public and Congress sort it out. It's an imperfect process, but so is democracy. I thought that was a pretty good description of what happened.
I mean to suggest that I think that this vindicates Snowden. David would say that it does. David would say he didn't need any vindication. Maybe I should let you speak for yourself, but I think I know what you're going to say. I'm not saying that I don't think Snowden should be prosecuted. I don't know whether he should or shouldn't. But I just want to be clear about that. I also want to say that a lot of people who have cheered what happened here with regard to these revelations. And I'm not speaking of the media. I think that the media did a tremendous public service, but I'm talking about Snowden and others of his ilk. I think some people, many of us, will be singing a very different tune the next time the United States is the subject of a large-scale, horrific terrorism act on our own shores.
Sobering. Let me move us to a third topic, and that is that there's 20-some thousand people down in Cortland, and I guess their friends around the country, that are pretty upset about something, and that is, while they love their jets, who are going to come this summer, and all the economic boost, they don't like one of the Jets' new players, and that's a guy named Michael Vick. You will remember that he served almost 2 years for federal dogfighting. And the petition that's been circulating that all these thousands have signed says that if SUNY welcomes Vick on its campus, it is complicit in his crimes and is turning a blind eye to the horrors of dogfighting. So, Bob Spitzer, we've got you right there in the heart of it. What do you know about this, and what do you think?
Well, it's a very interesting story. It's become a national story. These 20,000 signatures, it's an online petition. These are from all over the country. And the people sign on anonymously, so we don't know how many of them are in Cortland and how many are in, you know, Kalamazoo and Albuquerque. I did speak with our college president. I don't want to go on at too great length about that conversation, but he did tell me that he has been inundated by messages from all over the country on this issue. And you know, I have gone to the Jets camps in the summer in the past, and, you know, it's a great thing for the Cortland area. But the one of the things that bothered me from the outset was that the initial petition that went out had at least two pieces of information in it that were just wrong. And I think if you have to lie, or if you're too lazy to find out the truth in the first place to rally support, that's a problem. So this petition said, for example, that Vic had never once apologized for the animal cruelty. Now, I don't know if in his heart he's sorry or not, but he went on an apology tour after he got out. He gave dozens of talks, co-hosted with the Humane Society, to apologize, you know, speaking on campuses and to other groups, saying this was wrong, and, it, you know, one of these grand apology tours like, you know, celebrities do, right? So he not only apologized, he apologized endlessly. And they also, this petition also said that Vic even admitted that he would continue to fight dogs if given the chance. There is no verification that anybody's come up with that there's any truth that he said that. And, you know, if you have to say that in a petition to persuade people to, you know, rally against Vic, that I find bothersome. I also find bothersome the fact that this is all done anonymously, although apparently the name of the person who started the petition might be known. I heard somebody said it. But the larger problem is SUNY Cortland is in no position to tell the Jets whether Michael Vick can come or not. And certainly the college can pull out of the agreement. We have a contract with the Jets, and either side can withdraw from that agreement. We could, you know, the college could decide we don't want the Jets to come to Cortland. But the question is, do you do that based on this? And that is a complicated question. The man did serve his time. You know, he was convicted. He served his time. Is he entitled to resume the profession in which he engaged? And let me say finally, without going on too long, that, you know, what he did, if you've read the accounts about the animal cruelty, it's unspeakably horrible. And it went on for years, and it involved many people, but he was kind of the ringleader. I mean, it was, you know, indescribably terrible. On the other hand, there certainly is no shortage of people in the NFL today who are not spousal abusers, felons, people who committed felons but avoided prosecution because they were protected football players. You know, so these people are not choir boys. So if you're going to start, you know, raising the bar about, you know, NFL teams in terms of their felonious behavior of their members, I'm not sure who's left.
Thank you.
David? Sorry, go ahead, Tara.
One of the other things that concerns me about this is, you know, the level of ire that is aimed at Michael Vick. And if you read the commentaries about this petition, numerous people commented that they considered, you know, an animal the equivalent of a human being. And that's where I have to draw the line. I'm sorry. Horrible, absolutely. But these were animals. These were not human beings. And people are treating Michael Vick like he was, you know, training human beings and having them fight in a ring. I think we do that. It's called boxing. I don't see us, you know, having people arrested for that. So, you know, I really think the proportion is gone here. And for some of the people, if you read some of the commentaries, it's moved to obsession. What also concerns me is these same people who are saying that Michael Vick shouldn't be allowed to be at Cortland at Jets campus or at at the Jets practice. Some of them are also going beyond that. He and his family, his publicists, have received numerous death threats. You know, I'm sorry, there's a problem here, and if Courtland gives in to this, it will only get worse.
Two observations. One is that only at this point, a dysfunctional organization would have signed Michael Vick to begin with. And the Jets are definitely a dysfunctional organization.
Is that because of his character or because of his football playing?
Well, he hasn't got much football ability left, but I'm thinking here of the issue of character. The owners of these teams have an enormous investment in these players. They're doing ever more research into the character of the players that they're drafting. And right now, in the build-up to the draft in May, most of these organizations, physically, they know about these guys. They're now into background checks, the likes of which we wish were done on NSA employees. And the reason for that is that they know how much is at stake. So only an organization that is as dysfunctional as the Jets would have ever put themselves into this position to have hired Vic, given what they know about him. The second thing, which is not quite related to that, is that your president is going to have an interesting test this summer on First Amendment grounds, which is that some hundreds or thousands of people may descend on your campus to demonstrate with signs and so on. And the SUNY campus has to abide by First Amendment freedom of speech rules more than a private campus would. So how your campus chooses to balance the speech rights of the protesters and the Jets' rights to practice will be very interesting to see. And given that, as you know, I've never been a big fan of Cortland building its economic well-being around the New York Jets, I'm happy to see your president confronted with this problem.
One thing I will say is that our college president and the administration will be holding hands with every SUNY lawyer that they can reach out to, and that's how they'll handle it.
And what does the lawyer on our panel think about this?
Anything that's good for lawyers is good.
See, we're boosting the economy, lawyer employment in Cortland, New York. Woo-hoo! Yep.
Christy, you have any comments on this one?
I mean, I agree with Bob. I think there's, I'd make one point. I think there's a real distinction between, in terms of free speech and thinking about how people participate in politics and civil society, between the potential demonstrators, and they do have a right to come and demonstrate and so on, and this anonymous online petition, which I find, as you do, not to have a whole lot of validity. I mean, this is what an example, I suppose, of what people call slacktivism. I mean, it's you have these petitions, and I'm sure they come across your email a lot too. Sign here, your Facebook, you know, sign, and it strikes me as those are so meaningless. I mean, you just put your name on them, or you put a name on them, and they count up to 20,000. And this is putting aside the fact, as you say, that the grounds for people signing this are based on falsehoods or based on wrong assumptions. So I just think that shouldn't be paid too much attention to.
All right, it is time to, I like that word, slacktivism. I guess to talk about who's been a slacker this week, we're going to open up the grade book and have some Fs. And David, we will start with you.
Okay, so mine is tied to tax day, which was Tuesday, of course. And this I got from the column by Andrew Ross Sorkin in the New York Times, which really got me going at breakfast. Maybe you already know this, which is that if you and I, as individual taxpayers, are arrested and we admit guilt and we reach a civil settlement with the government, we cannot deduct the cost of that civil settlement from our taxes. But if a business, say J.P. Morgan Chase, reaches a civil settlement for its misbehavior, as it has, with the government, it can deduct from its taxes most of its settlement and all of the legal costs that went with it. And that strikes me as really unfair, and another reason why our tax code needs to be changed. So an F to the tax code.
Mine's tax-related as well. It's one thing to treat unfairly individuals who get into trouble with the tax authorities versus corporations. Even worse, I think, is beating up on legitimate corporations who pay their taxes. And so my F goes to Senator Carl Levin, Democrat from Michigan, who this week held a five-hour hearing to upbraid an accused Caterpillar Corporation of tax avoidance, he said. The theory is that Caterpillar has a Swiss affiliate that sells replacement parts. Never mind the fact that the reason that Caterpillar has that affiliate is because it sells a lot of American-made products to foreign companies and needs to be able to get those parts to them, and that it's good for America to have U.S. products being sold abroad. Never mind the fact that Caterpillar paid 29% in taxes. This is the top bracket paid by multinational corporations. Carl Levin admitted that Caterpillar broke no laws. Caterpillar has 52,000 employees in the United States, and presumably that's good for America. And never mind the fact that Congress, of which Senator Levin is a member, that writes the tax laws and not Caterpillar.
This is non-tax related. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee said this week that he is, quote, beginning to think that there is more freedom in North Korea than there is here in the United States. His evidence seemed to be mostly he didn't like TSA searches at the airport, and he also referred to the dispute between the U.S. Bureau of Land Management and a Nevada rancher about whether he can graze his cattle on federal lands. I really hope that Huckabee doesn't really want to compare these things with the crimes against humanity that a U.N. commission recently documented in North Korea.
My F goes to the Treasury Department, so it's tax related too. And it's related, it goes to the Treasury Department for its pursuit of debts allegedly owed to it, not by current law-abiding taxpayers, but generally by their parents for overpayment of Social Security funds. There are numerous problems with this procedure, the most important of which is the lack of due process for the accused taxpayers.
This past weekend, there was a report from the University of Montana that football players on their highly touted team there essentially avoided prosecution in rape cases, no improper investigation, no charges being brought, DA stepping aside and defending the players. And in yesterday's New York Times, a front page story, it's worth tracking down, about Florida State University, where their marquee player, Jameis Winston, who won the Heisman Trophy and led them to a national championship, had apparently committed a rape, and where the police conducted no investigation, where the district attorney conducted essentially no investigation, where evidence disappeared, where everything was dragged out, and this happened back in 2012, and in the intervening time, leads the team to a national championship, wins the Heisman Trophy. I find these kinds of stories coming out of universities to be utterly appalling, and it makes me ashamed to call myself a college professor.
This is a season when those of us who are Christian remember incidents that happened 2,000 years ago when people in power paid an informant to spy on a religious group that had practices that were not the norm. And something similar has been happening in New York City with the practice of the NYPD's demographic unit infiltrating Muslim groups and even declaring mosques suspected terrorism enterprises. It's led to so much suspicion on the part of Muslims in the city, tension between them and the government, and it's certainly outdone any noble purpose that this unit had for preventing terrorism. So the practice is my F, but I can thankfully say that New York City has disbanded the unit as of this week. Let's move along and do A's.
Well, Bob Spitzer is going to like this A, and it goes to the...
Andrew Cuomo.
Right, in your dreams. It goes to the student newspaper at the University of Michigan, the Michigan Daily, which discovered that the place kicker on the University of Michigan football team was accused of committing a rape in 2009. And that it took 4 years for the university to reach a decision as to whether or not he was guilty of this, which they decided he was, just at the point that he was finished kicking for the University of Michigan. So I guess you can say an F to Michigan, but an A to the student paper for ferreting this out.
My A was actually going to go to the New York Police Department for disbanding the demographics unit, but I'll jump to a secondary A, which is tax-related. It goes to Donald Rumsfeld, who apparently writes every year to the IRS to complain about the complexity in the tax code, and he wrote in the vein of known unknowns, right? He wrote that he and his wife know that they have no idea whether their tax returns and the amount that they paid are correct, and I think that many of us would say the same thing.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have a secondary A, and my A is also to the New York City Police Department and its new commissioner, William Bratton. They've terminated this so-called demographics unit, which was established, as Barbara said, in 9/11 to spy on Muslims, basically. Charting where they worshiped, where they ate, who they talked to, and so on. This program is the target of several lawsuits, and it should be noted also that in more than 10 years of operations, it has never generated a useful lead.
My A goes to French business and labor unions for agreeing to allow employees to disconnect from their remote communication tools, as they call them, during France's recognized 11-hour rest period. Now, considering the increase in stress-related accidents and shootings, this is a good reminder that rest is as important as work is.
And I'm giving an A to singer Billy Joel, who took time out to attend a kindergarten music concert at a nearby elementary school. He lives on Long Island, because they were doing a program of Billy Joel music. And he snuck into the auditorium just to hear the concert. Unfortunately, people started to recognize him. It began to make a commotion. And so he wound up leaving. The concert was fairly short. But it was a nice gesture on his part.
Very nice. My A goes to the voters of East Syracuse in their decision to abolish their police station and move the officers over to the town of DeWitt, who will now give them protection starting next year. I believe we may now have 899 governmental units instead of 900. Actually, they're not a governmental unit. The village itself would be. But we have long talked on this panel. I know Christy, Lisa have talked a lot about government consolidation, and I hope that this paves the way for other entities in our county to begin looking at consolidation. So A to them. And this is the time that I usually say, thank you for watching and please write us. But since you're right here and we have a few minutes, we have time for some questions and comments, either to agree or disagree with our three topics, or perhaps you have another question for the panel about another topic or some behind-the-scenes ivory tower info. So, Sandy?
Thank you very much.
I would just caution against sort of lumping Native Americans and nations of Native America based on the actions or deals made by one individual.
Okay. Good one. Questions?
There's one behind you, I see.
Sorry. John.
You were talking about fracking. My question is, perhaps we should look at this and think of it as a rather wise move, in that as more research is done in the fracking industry, there will be less pollution that will be caused by fracking in the future. And New York State may profit by that.
I actually think I think in retrospect, Cuomo's decision to delay the fracking decision is a good idea. The gas is in the ground. It's not going anywhere. And useful to see what's happening in other states with fracking, like Pennsylvania and elsewhere. So I think there's more wisdom behind it than one might think.
Okay. Question over here. Excuse me.
Thank you. I would be interested in hearing some of the behind the scenes, how you put your topics together, and do you do it all by email, or how do you come up with your format for each show?
David, you want to take that? David's the regular moderator and does most of the work. I just sub in every once in a while.
Beginning Saturday mornings, I'll start making lists of possible stories. And I sit down on Wednesday morning, and we're all on a listserv, and I'll send to the group anywhere from 6 to 9 possible stories that I would be comfortable moderating and I think would create a good discussion. By mid-afternoon on Wednesday, they get back to me. They vote, basically. It's a, I run a benevolent democracy. and they'll vote. And there's often pretty good unanimity. I ask them to pick three stories out of the group. And if there isn't unanimity, I'll play the votes back to them, although they've read it anyway, and then make them re-vote. But by Wednesday afternoon, we've decided. That then gives them Wednesday night and Thursday to prepare. If something important happens Thursday, we have changed the lineup. We can do that. And I remember on one occasion, we actually changed the lineup because something happened as we were driving to the studio Friday morning to tape at 8:30, and that's when the Nobel Committee awarded Barack Obama the Peace Prize in his first few months in office, and we decided, whoa, you know, we better talk about this. So we can change on the fly if necessary. The one thing I try to do is to avoid putting a story on the list, such as, say, a jury deliberation in a major case, where they might come in on Friday after we've done the show, and then we'll look like idiots when it's on the air Friday night. So I'll try to avoid that sort of thing. So that's the basic process.
Not that sometimes we don't look like idiots anyway. But
say sometimes he's more of a benevolent dictator than a leader of a democracy. He requires us, as he said, to vote on three. Sometimes it's quite tempting to engage in some strategic voting on two. And he never, ever lets us get away with it.
And the panel is very set in their ways. I know whenever I re-vote, you guys always just vote the same way all the time. So then the moderator has to pick.
I was just going to ask a question since I don't see any hands up. This week, Syracuse University, it's probably not a verb, held an inauguration for a new chancellor. So four of you on the panel are SU faculty. Your advice for the new chancellor?
Uh-huh. Lisa, I'll start with you so I can think.
I think so far my advice would be to keep up what he's done. He's made quite a favorable impression, I think it's fair to say, generally on campus. And including, you know, the students in particular love these weekly emails that he sends out. And he's got a very interesting way of communicating mm-hmm. with the campus. He seems to be a very humble man and one who is genuinely interested in listening and learning. He's got a tremendous task. Yesterday's Senate meeting, one of the committee chairs was speaking, and the chancellor was sitting right there, and said something like, "You must feel like you've been parachuted into a battlefield and have no idea who's shooting at you." So I think he's got a quite challenge. But I would say keep up what he's begun.
Yes, I think what his agenda needs to be and what has signaled that it will be is to refocus the university's attention on the quality of the education that the SU students are getting on the campus, to improve those units that really need improvement, to improve the overall national reputation of the university as a place for outstanding academics. He's got to get the budget under control. We can't keep spending like we've been spending. We are not that wealthy an institution compared to our peer group. And I'm happy to say that in these emails to which Lisa refers, he almost never mentions athletics, which I think is really, really good. Because in the last 8 years, there's been far too much emphasis on the trivia of SU sports.
I would say quickly that I thought one of the most important things and interesting things that he said during his inauguration was that, and this is, you know, he feels he needs to respond, I think, to some of the things that Nancy Cantor did to connect the university with the community and to be an important part of the community. And he said the most important thing that Syracuse University can do for the community is to be the best research and teaching university it can be. I mean, that's paraphrased, but I thought that was an interesting indication of how he's thinking about things.
I really admire him as a person who cares and has really strong values. He is very, I think, deeply interested in the teaching mission. He is a teacher at heart. And if you didn't hear his inauguration, I think he signaled a lot. The first three words in his speech were grace and humility. He's got a tough job, particularly with the budget, but I'm ready to follow him.
Bob and Tara, anything to add? We're good. All right, one more quick question.
Would you care to comment on the relationship between our mayor and our county executive? It seems to be unprecedented cooperation on one hand, and yet some very strange public statements that caught each other by surprise. So.
Oh, you asked a big one, and they could all talk a lot, but yeah. We'll let David answer that because I think we only have a minute or two.
Well, let me say that that it is tragic that a relationship that started out so strong has now become so difficult. And I will tell you, I mean, some of you know that I publicly bickered with the county executive, so I've bet on the mayor because I think she's right in this. I'll tell you what I think is happening. The county executive has thrown in with the governor. They have some kind of thing. I mean, they really seem to like each other. And I don't mean a thing, but they seem, you know, they...
Just keep talking, David. You're doing just fine.
Yeah, they seem to like each other. And I think that her attacks on the mayor are basically the governor's attacks on the mayor. And that she is carrying his water at this point. And while he clearly won't put anything into Syracuse, that Nano Film School is in DeWitt and not Syracuse for a reason, because it's not Syracuse. But he has stopped directly attacking her. He still does it. At the Center State lunch this week, he never mentioned her, but he mentioned every other public official in the audience. I mean, it's just rude. But at this point, he's letting Joni attack the mayor. And she's doing it. Now, why is she doing it? Well, you've heard the speculation, I think, that she thinks she's somehow going to replace Duffy on the ticket. I think that's ludicrous. I don't see what Cuomo gets with his base by appointing a Republican to be lieutenant governor. And the Republicans won't like it because a lot of them don't even view her as a Republican. So why he would do this, I don't know. We'll find out by the end of May, because he said by then he's going to pick a lieutenant governor. But if she's doing this at his behest, it's tragic, because this is not good for the community.
I see some people shaking their heads, and we probably need to wrap it up, but afterwards you might get some other opinions if you have a chance to talk to the rest of us.
Maybe you'll want to add this to your program tomorrow. But anyway, I do want to remind everyone that the Ivory Tower Half Hour is on WCNY on Friday nights, but this Ivory Tower Hour will be on WCNY-FM on Sunday at 8 p.m., so we'll be able to hear it all again. Thank you all very much.